This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're in the studios of the library. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and I'm with Katie Lehman, who's the author of Emily Dickinson's Lexicon. Emily Dickinson was, of course, America's greatest poet and inspiration. So I'm asking Katie to read a poem by Emily Dickinson before we go into her own work. Katie, give it to us.
I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb. When one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room, he questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth, themselves are one, we brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen met a night, we talked between the rooms, until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names.
Who was she?
Emily Dickinson was a 19th century poet from Amherst, Massachusetts. She lived most of her life in Amherst, except for a year when she went to Mount Holyoke Seminary when she was 17. She really redefined poetry for the modern reader. Wasn't known at all during her time.
Wow.
In fact, her 1,775 poems were not discovered until after her death.
Whoa, she is a legend. But I love that you are continuing this, her journey. I really love that you are with her still, not letting us forget her. How did she inspire you? How did she trigger something in you? Why Emily Dickinson?
I think there's this dichotomy where she is known to be quiet, but also this fierce language and...
Oh, that's a great thing to say.
Yeah.
That is a great thing to say. It is true. I've never heard anyone say it quite like that. She's an introvert. She's a recluse. But fierce language, what a great thing to say. Oh, and this triggered something in you.
Yes.
You're pretty fierce yourself. So let us hear one from your own book. What is in this book? Emily Dickinson's Lexicon.
Yeah, so I think... I've carried her book with me since I was 17, and I think this book is an homage to Emily in a way. And I'm writing about autobiographical aspects of her life.
It's like me with Emily Edna St. Vincent Millay. I fell in love with her at 17 and spent the next 10 years walking around quoting her.
Yes.
And she represented something that I could have. And I believe I see that with you and Emily. So read us one of your poems.
So this is a poem about the one picture of Emily Dickinson when she was 17, and it was taken during that year that she was at Mount Holyoke Seminary. And I just like to imagine what was that day like for her? What was it like for her going there and waiting there for her turn to be photographed? Her daguerreotype. Just prior to her portrait sitting, she stood next to the damask drapery, hem to hem, with its back layers of muslin and dimity to let in the sun, while the eager Mount Holyoke daguerreotypist immersed himself in the theatrics of setting up his camera obscura in all its myriad parts. Leveling stand, copper plates coated on the face with silver nitrate, iodine and bromide boxes, cabinet and clamps, until his two arms with one gesture signal Emily to the unseen chair. Her bold chestnut burr hair is pinned back. Her supply plump hands with long narrowing fingers that crossed the laced ribbon around her neck just an hour before now clasped the flowers she had turned quickly back to pick. Her light glancing eye had caught sight of them on her way there. shoulders angling down, her right arm with inch-wide cuffs, Baroque tablecloth, a book, a Bible, form a still life with disembodied hand. Is that her finest brocade? Did she speak, smile? Her lips do not say in the absence of not just hers, but all 19th century teeth. How long did her erudite gaze linger in ambient light before her image over blue mercury flame materialized on a plate that would otherwise be a mirror? Mm. Before her likeness, her sherry-colored eyes, her wren-sized frame, as she wrote to Higginson, imprinted on history. But this is 1847, before she lost a world or felt a funeral in her brain, though a fixed melancholy has set in. At home on North Pleasant, her bureau is yet devoid of poetry, the 40 fascicles bound with string, but holds one green-bound herbarium in which she has already decided to press the pansies with loose strife stem.
What I like about your work is you enter her being and you say, what was it like to feel that? What was it like to wait your turn? You see, you really do more than write about her. You enter her. What research did you do? I mean, did you have to read? You read everything she ever wrote, every biography, I'm sure. But tell us a little bit about your research.
I think it's just from spending a lifetime with her poetry with me, and just she's became a friend, a kindred spirit, and
that shows up in the book, I think. People need to get this book because it's not your usual Emily Dickinson book. It's Emily Dickinson's lexicon. It is, she enters her spirit. Katie Lehman enters her spirit. I'll tell you who the author is. She received her MFA from the University of Notre Dame, and she was the recipient of the Academy of American Poets Prize, given to excellence in poetry. That must have been a good energy boost for you. An assistant editor of the University of Notre Dame Press, and we will continue to hear more about her. Let's go on with Emily. What's next in your book? I don't think the world has heard this, and so I think it's really a contribution because so many people have approached her as a scholar, but what I like is that you are dealing with her spirit, and that is what the contribution you're making today. Radio is perfect for spirit, you know. Let's hear the next one. What's it called?
It's called Emily in Her Conservatory.
Okay.
She had a small greenhouse, and she would spend hours in there in the winter. And so, again, I was imagining her being in there. And also, she liked to send flowers to friends. And this is...
And you know something about flowers yourself. There's a great deal of crossover here. Let us hear this.
Emily in her conservatory. I send you inland buttercups as outdoor flowers are at sea. Emily Dickinson to Sarah Tuckerman. Through oleander in oxalis, her auburn chestnut hair, dark pink pinwheels, light pink stars, lavender bells. The spice aisles, she wrote, just beyond the Homestead's library. Emily in the tropics, a worsted shawl over a fiddleback chair, a plait of low-lying geraniums, purple heliotropes, her sloping shoulder by a shelf of soil-dusted bulbs bulging above their brief expanse of earth like cypress knees. Fringed gentians, the sweet lemon scent of daphnes, red camellias, a white jasmine from Mr. Bowles, her hands turning chalky, clay-fired pots under thick, waxy leaves. A soft hum in the warm enclosure, frost on the south-facing pane, wood-smelling ferns in its humid center. She'll mail them, her inland emissaries, to meet every anguish or ordinary hour. Black velvet ribbon around February bouquets. What summer her winter garden now makes, until the June delphinium breaks the horizon like a tall masted ship, its bow wake unfurling, triumphant from the sea.
How did you know the flowers, or did you imagine them?
No,
or are they in literature?
They're from her poetry. She names them.
Oh, she names them.
And her herbarium.
And so through knowing that, did you just jot them down? Or is it from your constant reading of her that they were embedded in your mind? How did you know them? Did you go through her poetry and collect those flowers?
Probably, and also looking at her herbarium that she made before she started writing poetry, she collected flowers and pressed them.
Well, the fact that you're a gardener as well has interested me too. There are just so many crossovers I see that one cannot avoid. So tell us about the eulogy. There are 8 pages of eulogy in this book that are too large for the small window of radio. But you really, those are your absolute strong devotional pictures of her, the eulogy. What did it take to write 8 pages? Did you do it in 8 days? Did it take 8 months? Was it line by line? What does it take for a huge, ambitious centerpiece? How long did it take you?
I think it was for my Master's of Fine Arts program. And so we had to write a poem each week. I'm thinking I probably didn't get it done in 1 week, but maybe a section a week.
Oh, I see. And also having to get your master's is a great impetus to keep working.
Right.
So, I mean, because all of this could have been floating in your head. I mean, it could have been just ideas you lived with, but there was a reason you chronicled her life. So let's hear another poem. We're going to actually shift to your own work before we return to Emily. And there's a poem called Monarch that I'm going to ask you about because it seems to be related to Emily.
Monarch, cyclical and sparse, her eyelid-thin wings approach and disapproach among the grasses. Unassuming, she only covets what she knows, a single worn reed of herself, dark covert, uncoaxable as the worm she once was. Before the white spotted wings, before the stained glass veins, idling brown earth at close measure. Closer at length, but she knows closeness is not her answer. If it is a loveliness she feels or a kind of loneliness, only the husbandry of tears will make her radiance known. How her cautious love perplexes the moth who darts unblinkingly into the porch light. Filamental, she is compatible to late dusk or perceivable grief. Admonish, and she's gone. Yet I conspire she longs for earth's untiring clasp, longs even, all preconceptions removed, to lay her orange and black chivalry down.
I think that may be one of my very favorites. It is not only painterly, but is it a metaphor for Emily?
I think it could be. I wasn't thinking of that when I wrote it.
But it clearly, the reluctance, the what she knows, the only thing she knows is what she's close to. It
right.
is so, I thought it was knowingly written that the butterfly is, and we also, they're so perishable. They're so beautiful, but you can't really touch them or they'll die.
Right, and in Greek, the word butterfly and soul were the same.
Oh, that's even better.
Right.
See, it just keeps going on. It gets better and better. And so we're going to shift to some of your own work, which is in the same tone. You have a lot of Emily going on in you. And I think your work is energized by her language.
It really
is. Very much so. Although you never replicate it or duplicate it, there's a tone, a devotional tone toward language. And so let's hear another poem.
This one is called Now Horses, and it takes place on the west coast of Ireland, where I helped a Benedictine nun on her farm. Now Horses, Kylemore Abbey, Galway, Ireland. When the white tour bus with square black windows stops along the one-lane road, we are far beyond the coifed hedges, hidden in the brambles, our backs bent over thick blackberries. They like to see a nun and a young girl in red overalls, she says. If someone approaches, she'll pretend she doesn't hear. Let me talk, I, the quieter one of the two. What does it mean, now that she is gone and the fields have carried on? Now horses graze where she had kept her charolais, the earth hoof-tilled in the muddy months by four-legged beasts through each dew and each frost. She must be in the farm kitchen, near the table, near the worn-down chair, or in the gray dappled coats of the Connemara ponies, muscles twitching as if touched by a hand that is not there. An architectured but pliant anatomy they inhabit, forelocks brushed aside in the Atlantic air. There she would be, and not down the lane in the cemetery under a cross placed in sparkling rocks. Not at the far static end of the skyward pointing gables of the Gothic chapel, but in the mottled light of its window tracery, adrift in the angled corners cobbed with dust, along the path of its flying buttresses to where I think of her standing beside me under a tree's wide canopy, sheltering us from an October downpour one leaf-worn afternoon. But as soon as it begins, it will stop, and we'll merge from wet hedgerows heavy with light. Now then, she'll say, and we'll move on to the next thing. For a time, we'll forget life's brevity, the narrow streams that ran down our oversized raincoats, while side by side, in stillness we watched, Wellingtons lined up, two figures like horses waiting out the rain.
The reason I wanted you to read that poem was because of the indirect characterization, how you are not a declarative poet. You don't go head on. You create a person off stage. And often in theater, the person off stage is the most important character. So your poetry does that. So you are slant light. Mm-hmm. Which is the way Emily would put it, right at slant.
Right.
And you never hit the reader with an axe in the head. You always go with a scene, but in this case, the most important person is off stage. So I think that is a unique with your writing and the way you honor death in a way.
Right.
Because I think mortality is so difficult. Sometimes we have to do it slant.
Right. I think Emily knew that.
I think you did, too. You learned a lot from Emily.
Right.
We're thanking her today. We will dedicate this poem to Emily Dickinson, who is here among us. And we'll keep going further and farther. And Katie has done a lot in the present world. What was the name of the magazine, Fortnightly, that you were editor of?
Right.
That was a happening thing. And very contemporary poetry. And I know that you've been a teacher. And let me see what else you've done. You were the personal editor for the former teacher, the American poet and translator, David Jones.
John Matthias.
Oh, the scholar John Matthias.
Yes.
And the editor of Matthias's Regrounding a Pilgrimage, which was an edition that came out in 2018?
That's right.
Okay. So this book happened when? Emily Dickinson's Lexicon.
2023.
Okay. People don't know what it took to embody Emily, because on the cover, the fabric in the birds was her wallpaper, right?
That's right. That's from, they found a small sample of her wallpaper, and this is a reproduction based on that small fragment found in her room.
We're just talking about how the particular has been noticed in this book and how the tiny pieces of knowledge will shine forth. And today, Katie Lehman is shining forth and bringing Emily Dickinson to life. But now a Katie poem.
This poem is called Oxheart, for Howard Schubiner, M.D., It's all in your mind is almost insulting, implying there's something strange or weak about you, or that the symptoms are in your imagination. This is most unfortunate, since the symptoms are very real, the result of a very physical process. Dr. John Sarno, The Divided Mind. Taught elastic tomato, sweet heirloom from a grandparent's garden. Ox heart, whorled and bulbous, not as acidic, bladder-shaped, now round inflamed planet. Interstitial cystitis, a condition common in cats. The urologist taps the end of his pen. Looks like we've ruled out all the bad stuff. I consult my vet. Triglucosamine chondroitin, amitriptyline, cystoscopy with hydrodistension, an alkaline diet, take aloe vera, buy an aloe vera plant as symbol. Take a turn of mind. Tension myositis syndrome, the neurology of pain of chronic perception. From cortical regions, the brain fires off signals. Are you there? The body, earnest follower, answers, I'm here, I'm here. A conditioned response. Like Pavlov's dogs, the kind doctor says. I step into the neural fray, drink coffee, spoon spaghetti sauce from a jar. You will get better. I see this just about every day. I run out into the garden where my husband, the scientist, turns compost. It is early spring. His measured reply, we'll see, makes me question his belief. Yet mine, already rooted in August, ox heart, the sweat of the earth, an organ of earth.
That is pretty damn good. Really. First of all, I love the scientist who is equivocal. He will never support an idea, right? Which I love.
Right.
But the ox heart, didn't even know there was such a plant.
Right.
You know, and the fact that you know nature so well, but that it's the shape of the bladder. And I think only a poet would take a flower and associate it with a bladder, shape of a bladder. Only a poet. How did you make that connection? Was it its appearance?
Well, it was the appearance, and it was a time in my life where I was dealing with interstitial cystitis, which is a chronic condition. And so it was just always in my brain. And I saw a card that someone had painted of this heirloom tomato called Oxheart, and I thought,
it's a tomato?
Yes, the oxheart is the name of the tomato, of the heirloom tomato. And I thought, what a name. It sounds so strong.
That's what I get. That's what I want people to know about poetry. You take the ugly and make it beautiful. And that's our job. I mean, there's nothing pretty about a bladder.
Right.
But to make it into a natural growing thing, what is the last line of that poem again?
The sweat of the earth, an organ of earth.
Yeah. Which is kind of a surrender in a way, which your scientist is not willing to do.
Right.
And let's keep going on with Katie Lehman.
Of Thomas Merton for Kimberly Taylor. Tall oaks from little acorns grow. 14th century proverb. We spoke of Thomas Merton along the Chesapeake, how your father had been a monk at Gethsemane. Surprisingly stern, Father Louis mostly kept to himself, he said. When a branch we did not see fell, its hollow weight opened the sky into an airy silence. Then crow caws, trilling cadences that for the eye was like light playing on knives. What can we gain by sailing to the moon if we are not able to cross the abyss that separates us from ourselves, Merton wrote. Perhaps we are co-conspirators to the Judas inside us. Wayward pilgrims in Dante's dark forest. Or perhaps our flickering lanterns will lead us to a living stream, and from the bank we'll fix in each other's abyss a singular snail's boat made of bark. On its bow lay moss as berm, and on a vertical stick tie a fern by its stem. Then with an oak's acorn set out, first you, then me, our knees covered in leaves.
I think it helps to know that that was written to Kimberly Taylor, another poet who is like a sister to you, because the we in that, we hear the reverence in it, and it doesn't matter who it is,
right.
But it shows it's a companion that, of trust. That comes through, and people of a like mind to be in the shadow of Merton, you know, to be a believer
right.
in what Merton believed.
And to go through the journey of the dark night of the soul, but to have a companion with a lantern there as well.
Which is Gethsemane, the road to Gethsemane. Yeah, that is all. That's what I like about poetry, that you can just read the beautiful language and get a picture of it, but that there are so many rivers in rivulets going into rivers that if you read it three times,
right.
you get even three times more. The book is Emily Dickinson's Lexicon by Katie Lehman, and if you are an Emily lover, this is something you have to have on your shelf because it shows, actually, Katie enters Emily. So that's different from what you're going to get from the scholars, because the scholars will tell you what Emily did. Katie will tell you how she felt. And we're going to end with a poem to Emily Dickinson, I believe, by Katie Lehman.
Called Back, Emily Dickinson, December 10th, 1830 to May 15th, 1886. Sweet hours have perished here, Emily Dickinson. The white coffin, the white ribbon, carried out the homestead's back door, around her flowering garden, along a spring grass footpath, through the damp barn, through a field of yellow buttercups. After the afternoon fell, and an evening beam trod across her rose-papered wall, her blush plum paisley stole. After a world dropped down and down, and an air above her bed stood still. And Austin and Lavinia and Susan there, and the late daffodils and the punctual mayflowers silent. Just how then did her shape rise? In the dimming bustle by an oil-lit lamp, wet cloth on her brow, a light bristled brush, a metal comb. Her unchanged chestnut hair, Sue washing her body robed in white, blue violets and one pink cypripedium on her neck, where breath had been. Vinnie placing two heliotropes near her hand. Sparrows next will follow, a scattering of pine, an anemone and robins bold and fluttering will with her go on an almost summer day. A wild violet lens, a vital stir between her and her bow-lined grave, an old bravery then.
Say that last line again.
A wild violet lens, a vital stir between her and her bow-lined grave, an old bravery then.
Wow, an old bravery ends. That is Katie Lehman talking about America's most first modern poet. And here's a contemporary poet who is bringing her back to life. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress and Mike Turpin for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, and by friends of the program, Avide Shoshani, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. We love him. I'm Grace Cavalieri.